Hey, and welcome to another episode of Muscle for Life. I'm your host, Mike Matthews. Thank you for joining me today. And if you haven't already, please take a moment to subscribe to the show in whatever app you are listening to me in so you don't miss any of the new episodes. And it helps me by boosting the rankings of the show in the various charts. Okay, so in this episode, I chat with scientist and buddy, Dr. Bill Campbell, about a new study on rapid fat loss that came out of his lab. And this was an interesting discussion because in this study, what Dr. Campbell looked at is how aggressively can we cut our calories so long as we know what we're doing with our macros, with our protein intake, and we know what we're doing with our exercise regimen. How aggressive can we be with our cutting to maximize fat loss while still minimizing muscle loss? And many people say that we can't be all that aggressive. Many people say that if we cut our calories more than maybe 20% or so, if we eat less than about maybe 80% of the calories we burn every day, we are going to start losing muscle. We are going to start having terrible workouts. We are going to start feeling miserable. And, you know, this is something that I've questioned for some time. I've told people to not exceed 25% because in my experience working with a lot of people over the years, it did seem that once you got to 30% plus in terms of the size of your calorie deficit, things started to sour, at least workouts, energy, mood, not necessarily muscle loss. Of course, rapid fat loss was fun, but at what cost, right? And there's not just the physical component, but also the mental component and the emotional component. That said, though, something that has been established in the scientific literature and something that I've noticed anecdotally with many people, if you have a lot of fat to lose, you can be very aggressive with your cutting and experience no major negative side effects. You can eat 30%, maybe even upward of 40% fewer calories than you're burning every day for a period and lose a lot of fat and maybe even gain muscle if you're new to resistance training and feel totally fine. And so I have wondered over the years, how does that apply to those of us who are pretty fit and those of us who want to go from, let's say, lean-ish to very lean, especially those of us who have gained a lot of muscle? And again, that is what Dr. Campbell's study looked at specifically. And if you are not familiar with Bill, he is a professor of exercise science and the director of the Performance and Physique Enhancement Laboratory at the University of South Florida. And he has also published more than 150 scientific papers. So he is somebody who is not just interested in this stuff academically, but he is in the trenches. He is at the coalface doing the hard work. And he's a super nice guy and he's fun to talk to. Also, if you like what I'm doing here on the podcast and elsewhere, and if you want to help me do more of it, please do check out my sports nutrition company, Legion, because while you don't need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, and get healthy, the right ones can help. And that's why over 300,000 discerning fitness folk have chosen Legion and left over 25,000 five-star reviews for our products on our website and on Amazon. Well, that and our 100% natural and science-based formulations, our fanatical customer service, and our commitment to transparency, authenticity, and honesty. Now, Legion is also holding its biggest sale of the year right now and its biggest sale ever. This is our biggest and our bestest sale ever. We are trying to make up for last year's Black Friday Cyber Monday sale, which because of inventory constraints was not very exciting. This year, though, you can save up to 40% on everything, plus get free gifts on all orders over $99. And you can do that right now over at buylegion.com, BUYLEGION.com. And everything is on sale, including our protein powders, our pre-workout and post-workout supplements, fat burners, multivitamins, joint support, and more. So again, that URL is buylegion.com. Skedaddle on over to there. Save big, Hurry up though, because no matter what my exorbitant ERP software predicts, we always run out of stock of at least a thing or two every year during our big site-wide sales, especially our Black Friday sale. There's always that flavor or two or three, or that product or two or three that just blows up out of nowhere. So that means that your favorite flavors or products may or may not survive the onslaught. Do not risk such a calamity. Instead, head over to buylegion.com now and claim your discount and bask in the post-purchase glow. Hey, Bill. Thanks for taking time to come on my podcast again.
Yes, I think this is my second, maybe third.
So yeah. I thought it was the second, but you might be right. It might be the third.
I think it's the second. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to talk about rapid fat loss with you. And you had mentioned just before we started recording that this is a study you did that you can talk about because you presented it at a conference. It's not officially out yet, but that the results made you change your mind about something, which is, it's funny because I think it's just an interesting question that I've been asked and I've answered myself, I believe on the podcast. What is an example of something that I have changed my mind about in the context of fitness in the last, you know, year, 2 years, 3 years or whatever? And if I remember correctly, I gave like four or five or six different things. But that's something that is, I think it's a useful question to ask ourselves just in general, I think in any area of life. And I don't want to go off on a long tangent unrelated to rapid fat loss, but I think that if and this would certainly be the case for me, if I were to look back and say, look at myself a year ago, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and if I couldn't quickly pinpoint key changes in perspective, it doesn't have to be necessarily a complete 180 change, but something that some ideas that were somewhat foundational in how I live my life or how I view the world. And if that has not changed at all, if I couldn't answer that question, if somebody were to say, hey, what are a few things you've changed your mind about that are important in the last couple of years, I would be concerned. I would say I'm probably not doing a good job learning and thinking and trying to get better, you know?
Yeah, that would be an unexamined life, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so in the case of my work, you know, it's the same thing as where I'm happy, because I look at it as more like we are finding out how to be more right. I don't look at it as, oh, I was wrong, even though I was wrong about things in fitness a couple of years ago. And there are certainly things that I am wrong about right now. Maybe I don't know what they are yet, but I'm happy to find out what they are because then I can be more right. Do you look at it the same way?
Yeah. And it's funny because I'm a scientist. Like I get paid to read research, paid to do studies. And I have a lot of assumptions only because I haven't had time to dive into the research in all of these areas. And then when I do get the time or it's time for me to look into an area, I'm like, wow, the research doesn't support that at all. And all these years, I thought that this was true. So that's
life though. We don't have the time to confirm every single thing that we assume to be true. I mean, there are things that we have to say, well, I guess I could call that a believed fact, right? Like I haven't confirmed it, but I'm just going to operate under the assumption that it's true until proven otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. And if it's not, if it's one of those things that really doesn't matter, no big deal.
Of course.
Yeah. I don't want to go down this rabbit trail.
Yeah.
But
we're not here to philosophize, but you know, maybe.
No, but I'm actually bringing it back to fitness. The thing that I've been pouring myself into is concurrent training. And part of my research, I also do Google searches on this stuff as well. And one of your articles, I don't know if you wrote it, but it was a Legion Athletics. I mean, it is like right at the top. And I had already done 90% of my research. And I'm gonna read this. And of course, I like Legion. I know you. And I'm like, I wonder if they got this right. Or maybe not right.
Oh, you gotta let me know. Because I think that article, if I remember correctly, that article was written by, his name is Army. Interesting, unusual
That's
name.
That's it. Army Legge or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. So he's the director of content for Legion. And so, as you can see, he writes at the website. And this is an area of particular interest to him because he used to do a lot of endurance. Like, he has competed in triathlons and marathons, and he's been really into weightlifting. Now he's more into weightlifting, and he does endurance stuff, not competitively, just because he enjoys it and he wants to reap the health benefits. But this is an area that he has a lot of firsthand experience in, and he's been very interested in the research. So you have to let me know your take on his take. I'll stand behind his take, and it's in line with my understanding of things, but hey, we may be wrong.
No, like I said, I had done about 80% of the work, and I'm still doing work. I'm getting down to the last few studies looking at muscle biopsies and muscle specific measures like MRIs and CT scans on muscle hypertrophy. But yeah, I already came to my conclusion, and just you'd appreciate this. I can't stand reading review papers or meta-analyses first. I want to read the original articles first, get through, you know, at least six of those papers, because then I feel like I kind of know where their literature is taking me. And then at the end, now let me read the review papers, which is where I'm at now as well. And so I had already come to my conclusion that this whole concurrent training thing, at least as it relates to muscle hypertrophy, strength, I think there's an interference effect, potentially, not across the board, but on hypertrophy, there's very little there. And I was like, I always thought that there was, and it kind of, you know, I don't like doing cardio, so I was happy to live there. So again, that's we can do a whole podcast on that. But yeah, the article that Army wrote was so well done. It was
You did read it. Okay, good. All right, cool. And that's that's nice to hear, because again, he's a smart dude and he's into this stuff, and then my take on it was right in line with his. And so sometimes, you know, when we're planning out content, some things he'll say, hey, I'll take this, other things I'll take. And that's one he wanted to take because, again, it's something that he really, you know, likes, and he's put more time actually into researching it than I have. And he has, to your point, I think he, and it sounds like you came to a similar conclusion that it also is probably not very relevant to, let's say, everyday gym goers or even like lifestyle bodybuilders, as opposed to a competitive strength athlete who's like, you know, at an elite level, and particularly for that point of hypertrophy and even the strength performance. So long as you're willing to make maybe a few concessions on the cardio front, like if you're a very cardio focused and you really want to maximize your endurance performance, that may cause some issues. But if you're willing to think of it more as cardio, as opposed to, again, something that you're going to track and push and really try to, like, you know, squeeze every ounce of performance out of your body, then there's probably not much to worry about.
No. And the way that I've come to explain this, because again, I was just this morning trying to talk to my wife. I'm like, hey, I got to be careful because I don't want people thinking that you can do, you know, run marathons and you're not going to lose muscle. That's not what I'm saying. So the way that I'm understanding it is, if you want to do aerobic exercise as a supplement to your basic resistance training program, like you're saying, I think your level of concern can be alleviated. Now, clearly what we don't have is data in IFBB professional male bodybuilders who have, you know, 80 pounds of mass over the years. And I don't know. I mean, if there's going to be an interference effect there, maybe I would be a little cautious. But in all of the populations that are published, which is, again, not elite level bodybuilders, I'm having a hard time finding any evidence to support an interference effect on muscle hypertrophy. And, you know, there's some studies that actually suggest that it helps with hypertrophy.
Yeah, like I know in the case of cycling in the legs, for instance.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that literature, males, females, elderly, young, obese, lean, cycling, running, elliptic, like that's where it gets hard to come to firm conclusions because the variables are all over the place. Length of the studies, the intensity of the cardio, the duration of the cardio. But yeah, I was reading that article and yeah, I was like, wow, this is, it confirmed my own research in looking at that literature.
I'll pass that along to Army. He'll like to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. Please give him my sincere compliments on his writing ability as well. It was a pleasure to read.
That's great. Yeah. I'll definitely tell him he'll appreciate that because he, that's his primary work and that's what he really likes to do. He likes to read and research and he likes to write. So that'll be a nice compliment. But let's shift gears now and talk about rapid fat loss. And again, I had mentioned before we started talking about concurrent training that this study that you conducted, it made you change your mind about something related to rapid fat loss. Maybe we should start there just because it's interesting. I want to know.
Yeah. So again, just trying to guard against my message being taken to places where I don't want it to be taken. I'm not advocating for crash dieting. So let me start there. But if you want to severely reduce your calories under certain conditions, I now think this can be done without much harm to your muscle mass. I don't think I would have said that a year ago or 6 months ago. And again, what we can talk about, what are these things that you need to do, which they're not shocking in our space, but
let's get into the details. So what does this look like? You know, people listening are now wondering, okay, when, how much of a calorie deficit are you talking about and for how long and how would I do that correctly? And when should I consider doing that and so forth?
So let's, without going into the minutiae of, there's multiple other studies that have reported severe dieting or large caloric deficits cause a cellular reduction in anabolism. So an increase in muscle protein breakdown, a decrease in muscle protein synthesis. So I don't want to make that argument. That argument's already there. So there are other studies that have shown harm with severe caloric restrictions, particularly those where there's no resistance training and where higher protein intakes aren't followed. Mm-hmm. So that's a given, or at least let's assume that that's a given.
Yeah.
What we did in our study was we wanted to challenge, because I've said, I don't think severe caloric restriction or even aggressive caloric restrictions are a good idea. So I'm at a point.
What's aggressive to you? I'm curious.
I would have said, well, I think the literature leads me to believe over 30% is where I see some
aggressive
studies, yeah, showing that might not be ideal for maintenance of muscle mass. So I'm at a point in my career now where I have my thoughts and I'm starting to design studies to challenge my own thoughts. So here was the first study. Well, can we be aggressive? And what we did was we said, can we be aggressive with a caloric deficit? And I'll define what that was. But let's put in everything we know that will help prevent the loss of muscle and help prevent the suppression of metabolic rate or metabolism. So we basically said, we're going to do three things. The caloric deficit, I want it to be severe, but you know, severe at a point where people can actually stick with it. So we said about 37.5% over a 2-week period. So nearly
about double what would be considered not aggressive, but you know, something around 20%. That's usually where I would cut it off, 20, maybe 25 if I'm feeling frisky, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think my base is 25% just so people can feel and again, our research would suggest that's a very good place where you can maintain muscle mass.
Yep.
So there we said, okay, 37.5%, let's just call it approaching 40% of a caloric deficit. So it was only 2 weeks where they had to live here. We spent 2 weeks prior to that determining their maintenance calories so that we could, you know, be very specific about hitting this near 40% caloric deficit. So there's the first safeguard we put in. it's only going to be 2 weeks. We're not asking you to do this for 3 months or 4 months or something that would just be obscene, where they're, you know, people are eventually going to lose the battle to hunger. The other thing we did, which we do in all of our studies, is we also said you're going to resistance train. So that provides an anabolic stimulus to the body. So that will help preserve muscle mass. I don't know if it will help in this case, because that's a pretty severe caloric deficit. And then the other thing was a relatively high protein intake. So we instructed all of our subjects to ingest 1 gram per pound during this near 40% caloric deficit, or 2.2 grams per kg of body mass. So short, and throwing in protein's an anabolic nutrient, resistance training's an anabolic exercise mode. So trying to throw in as many anabolic variables into an otherwise very catabolic environment, which is a low caloric intake. So that was the study design. And this was males and females.
A simple approach, though, that anybody can do.
Yes. And that's one thing. My studies aren't perfect, but they're practical. They are designed for people to be able to do, with, generally speaking, with tools that people have. If you can track your macros, if you can have somebody test your body fat with skin folds, my research speaks to you. It doesn't get, you know, I'm not doing biopsies. Not that there's not value in that, but I place a high premium on relevance to normal people with what we do. So at first glance, as I'm going to share the results with you, the data is not good, but we took one extra step that is what flipped the switch for me. So these subjects dieted for 2 weeks. Oh, it's also it's important to know that this happened in the middle of COVID. So we had to shut down the study halfway through. And when we had to shut down, we had just gotten finished with half of the subjects in the study. And all of those subjects, half of them, they worked out in my lab. So I'd like to supervise all of the workouts, because that gives you a lot more confidence in what they're doing. And something else we did that was unique, we had them tell us what their normal programs were, and then what was their set volume. And then we just allowed them to continue doing what they were normally doing. So we didn't have a set program. Instead, we said, do what you normally do. Of course, it's in my lab, so there might have been a few adjustments, but the volume didn't change. And that allowed us to say the only real intervention here is a caloric deficit.
Yeah, that's smart.
So then, yeah, and you watch, the future of resistance training studies is going to do exactly that, because it does not make sense to give everybody the same program, because, as you know, half the subjects are doing half as much weight. Some are doing three times as much. And it totally convolutes your data. So I think you're going to see.
And that volume point is big too. You bring somebody in and then you ask them to do now 30, 40, 50% more volume than they are used to doing. That is going to induce changes. Like that is going to have its own effects.
Yep. Yeah. So you're hearing me predict the future of the research landscape as it pertains to resistance training. So, and then not after COVID, but because we're in Florida and we took I spent a lot of money. And by the way, Legion has donated money to my lab to just no strings attached. They just said, hey, if this helps your research. So Mike, I need to thank you. I need to thank Kareem. That money that you guys donated, at least some of it, literally was me buying, you know, all the gloves, all of the COVID wipes that kill COVID on surfaces. Face masks, like, so I need to thank you for supporting my research, because if I ever needed money, this was the time, because those supplies at that time were not cheap. So thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Unfortunately, I had to go to that stuff, but hey, the money was needed. So I'm glad you were able to make it happen.
So the second half of the study, because of this COVID environment, we weren't able to supervise all of the workouts any longer. So we supervised some of them, but not all of them. Actually, and that might've been a study, we weren't able to do any of that. We couldn't supervise them all only because of the COVID caveat. But of course we were able to, you know, use all of these safety supplies to keep testing the subjects for their body composition, metabolic
rate. And fortunately, they were just doing their normal programs. So yes. Not that supervision wouldn't have been valuable, but like you said, that is a safeguard, that you just wanted them to keep training the way they normally do.
Yes. So after the 2 week, and I'm just going to focus on the fat loss portion here. We actually had a 2 week post diet period, and we can talk about that later if you want. But the real value in this is what happened with the fat loss. And there was no there was no comparison here. There was a comparison, but for the sake of what we're talking about, this was just to see if you have this severe caloric deficit, do you maintain muscle mass or how much fat do you lose? So that's the main question. So very simple study design. After 2 weeks of, and this is 14 straight days, there's no diet breaks, there's no refeeds here, 14 straight days of this nearly 40% caloric deficit, they lost about, it was 1.5 kgs, let's say a little over 3 pounds of body weight. And then we look at, what's the composition of this weight loss? So to me, the standard is, and this really comes from the obese literature, the standard is about 3/4 of your weight loss should come from fat, and about 1/4 should come from, or not should, but typically 1/4 comes from fat-free mass. And fat-free mass isn't total muscle. It's body water, it's connective tissue, it's organs. But clearly there's a direct relationship. If you lose fat-free mass, you can... I think you can be pretty confident that you've lost muscle mass. If you've gained fat-free mass, you can be confident that you've gained muscle mass or contractile tissue. So this was the next thing, like, well, what was the composition? Are we better than what we typically see in the literature? The answer is no. The fat loss accounted for 2/3 or 66% of the weight loss. And then the fat-free mass was 1/3, so about 33%, which again, I kind of use it just as a standard guide. If and my other research studies, because we have high protein, because they're resistance training when dieting, we're very close to having a body recomposition standard in our weight loss study. So this was the first study where this happened. And again, it's probably not surprising. They had a pretty severe caloric deficit, even though it was only 2 weeks. But then we looked at the next analysis that we looked at was total body water. So we tracked their body water. And
that was going to be my question. So I'm listening.
Yeah. So you can probably see where this is going. So they lost, I said, at 1.5 kgs of total body weight, and 1/3 of that was fat-free mass. So 0.5 kilogram or about 1 pound. But when we looked at the loss of body water, 80% of the fat-free mass component was water. So they lost water. And what that means is the amount of what we call dry fat-free mass, which is now, I mean, you're talking minerals, protein, so much more of this is now your muscle. It was very small and no significant difference. None. When you accounted for the water loss over the 2 week period in this fat-free mass component, they did not lose any muscle mass. Again, it was 0.1 kilogram of fat-free mass. And again, that's still not all contractile muscle tissue.
Exactly.
That's still organ.
And whatever was or might have been, let's remember, and you know this, but for people listening, let's also remember that when these people, let's say this was going to be the beginning of a cut for them. Let's say they wanted to start this way and they were going to continue in a deficit. And whatever small amount of contractile tissue they might have lost in this initial phase and that they might lose over the next few weeks, whatever, will come back very quickly once they come out of a calorie deficit. So I always like to point that out for people who get, I think, a little bit too concerned about losing small amounts of muscle while cutting, especially, you know, I'll hear from people sometimes where they'll do great. They'll cut for, it might be 2 or 3 months, maybe a couple diet breaks in there, but they'll do a great job. They'll lose a lot of fat, but they'll be very stuck on the fact that, oh, they got DEXA scan and it said that they lost also 5 pounds of muscle. And I'll point out this body water point that, like, you didn't lose 5 pounds of muscle tissue. And then also, whatever muscle tissue you might have lost, remember, you're going to gain that back in your first couple of weeks of just eating normal again. So just take a W, like, you did well, you know?
Yeah. And two thoughts on that. One, you have to embrace the phase that you're in. And if you're in a fat loss phase, and I appreciate do things to protect your muscle mass, but don't shortchange yourself. Like, embrace a fat loss phase if that's what you're trying to do. Don't tiptoe around it, because why do it at all then? Yep. And then the second thing is, yeah, we did a 2-week ad libitum. So whatever they wanted to do, and they gained back actually a marginal amount of dry fat-free mass than what they had more of that than that they started than what they started the diet with. So it, not only did it come back, they actually had a little bit more, nothing statistically significant.
Right.
Something else, we also measured resting metabolic rate, and that's a great proxy for muscle mass, because the largest, other than body weight, the largest predictor variable of resting metabolic rate, at least in males, is lean body mass. And we did have a significant loss in the first 2 weeks of, and again, that's not all muscle mass and weight loss. That also closely tracks just caloric intake. So that's another huge component. If you want to increase your metabolism tomorrow, eat a lot today, yeah, and it will go up.
I mean, the thermic effect alone, there you go. You're going to burn some more energy.
Yes. But in the 2 weeks after, not only did the dry fat-free mass come back and the fat-free mass, but also resting metabolic rate came back as well. So yeah, that's a good point, or a good perspective to have. You're not losing all muscle, and you do get it back. Now, you could make the argument that is a month or however long your diet is, that is time that you didn't build new muscle, and I can appreciate that. But again,
I'm assuming you wanted to cut for a reason, right?
I mean, yes. Yes. And again, my message is always protect muscle, but embrace the phase you're in. You're going to have hopefully large parts of the year where you're going to build muscle. Yeah. And I don't think that, I think what you're saying probably is true. You're never losing that muscle and it's gone forever. It's a short term fix. So I did say high protein. So about on average, half of their calories were coming from protein in this study. In some subjects who were eating low calories to start, because we set an absolute amount, they were eating almost pure protein.
I was going to ask you, I have a few follow-up questions. So one is, I'm sure that you are familiar with the protein sparing modified fasting approach to dieting. And that's something that I first heard about years ago from Lyle McDonald. Mm-hmm. He had spoken about it. And if I remember correctly, he didn't just give it a blanket endorsement. He felt that it was useful. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but if I remember correctly, it was useful for certain people under certain circumstances, basically. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on how what you saw here compares to what has been seen. I know there's limited research on that. And then from there, I'd like to hear your thoughts for people listening, wondering what would be a practical use for this? And I know that they're going to be thinking about, okay, we have a 2-week duration. What if, can I do this for 4 weeks and quickly strip off a bunch of fat? And so I don't want to throw too many things at you. I'll hold the rest of the questions in, but.
Yeah. So I think our study is the closest thing you're going to find in the population that we kind of serve.
Which is great, which is cool.
Yes. Yeah. I wouldn't say it's a protein, a very high, I mean, it is very high relative to literature, but I believe a protein, what's the term?
It's PSMF, right? Protein sparing modified fast. Yeah. If I remember, that's like pretty extreme. You basically are eating 150 to 200 grams of protein per day, and that is it.
Yeah. So I'm not going to say we did that, but again, this is the closest thing to that. And in some subjects, 10%, 15%, it literally was that. And I think that makes sense to me. If you're trying to lose fat quickly, give your body as much anabolic variables or an anabolic stimulus. Protein is anabolic. Resistance exercise is anabolic. And caloric deficits are not. So offset that. So you could say we just threw everything we knew at this to protect muscle. And we did. We did everything we could to protect metabolism. And I mean, it could have been worse. I guess it could have been better. It is what it is. Now, again, after 4 weeks, it was back to a non-significant decrease from baseline. And then what was your second question? Oh, yeah. how can this be applied?
Yeah.
Can we do this for 4 weeks? Well, I think that's the $1 million question.
Yep.
How can we go a third week and not see a decrease in dry fat free mass? How long can we go? Now, at this point, I'm going to say, if you're going to do this, it needs to be short. Cause that's what my data suggests, but maybe longer. Maybe you do a refeed after the first 2 weeks for, you know, 2, 3, 4 days, and then do another 2 weeks. The research is kind of, and that's where we're going to go next. We're going to build off of this and start asking those next questions. So if you have ideas on what you think's most relevant, let me know, because that might be what we do.
If you like what I'm doing here on the podcast and elsewhere, and if you want to help me do more of it, please do check out my sports nutrition company, Legion, because while you don't need supplements to build muscle, lose fat, and get healthy, the right ones can help. Legion is also holding its biggest sale of the year right now, and its biggest sale ever. You can save up to 40% on everything, plus get free gifts on all orders over $99. And you can do that right now over at buylegion.com, BUYLEGION.com. Yeah, that would be an interesting approach. And by refeed, I'm assuming you're thinking bring calories back up to maintenance.
Yes.
For maybe 5 days or something, maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah. That I would define that as a diet break. Refeeds. Yeah.
You're thinking shorter. Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Because again, I want to embrace the fat loss phase, but I mean, anything's in play here. Something else I've thought about is what if we did this for a month, but every weekend. So it's very aggressive. But every weekend we go back to maintenance. And then we have another group who just kind of just goes, you know, no refeeds, and they're not quite as aggressive. So there's rabbit trails are kind of endless, but I think this is very practical. And part of my philosophy is I don't want people to be in a perpetual diet. So part of the thinking of this study was, can we come up with something where if your motivation is high, can we leverage that where you're highly motivated to kind of beat hunger for a short period of time? So almost let's kill it for a short period of time and then get out. And by getting out, not having a food orgy for the next month, going back to maintenance, and then maybe in another month, kill it again. So that's kind of part of the motivation here is, almost like intermittent aggressive approaches rather than the typical longer duration diets that people incline to do.
That could be interesting in the context of even lean gaining. If you think about the slow fat accumulation that comes with a slight calorie surplus and then hitting it every so often with some aggressive cutting, to ultimately, with the goal, of course, being if we were to look at it over the course of a year, just being able to spend more time in a calorie surplus as opposed to the more traditional where you're lean bulking until you're just too fat, basically. And then you have to cut for probably in most people, it's at least a couple of months. It's at least 8 weeks, maybe as long as 12 weeks before you are lean enough to do your next round of lean bulking. So there's the element of that it, I guess, would be more related to efficacy. And then there's also enjoyment. I know a lot of people, of course, they don't particularly like that approach. Because they like the beginning of both of the phases usually. And I've experienced this myself. The beginning of that lean gaining phase is cool because, you know, you're eating more food and you're having great workouts and you're just noticing more energy and maybe even better sleep. But then as you get deeper into a lean gaining phase, you get sick of eating so much food and you have to continue to increase your calorie intake usually to continue gaining. And then you really get sick of eating food and then you start cutting and it's nice to just cut your calories literally in half. Maybe like that's how it was. I haven't done that in a while, but my last lean gaining phase, it ended at about 4,000 calories per day. I felt like I was force feeding myself my final meals of the day. I just felt gross basically every day. And I started my cut, maybe not at 2000, maybe 2,500, but it was a relief just to not eat 4,000 calories per day. But then of course, after the first month or so of that, And now the workouts are starting to flag and energy levels are lower, and you just keep going, obviously. But it may be more enjoyable to do what you were just suggesting. And this would be on an individual level, but again, to use that calorie surplus, and for the timing, maybe it's a month or something. It depends on various factors, but then to do an aggressive fat loss for a couple of weeks where you almost still have that momentum built up from the calorie surplus. And, you know, maybe in those couple of weeks, you don't get any performance bump, but you don't notice any reduction either. You just get a bit leaner, you lose a couple pounds of fat and get right back to it, you know?
Yes. And something else, earlier this summer, I was really diving into this constrained energy expenditure model. I imagine you're familiar with that. So, and it's funny, I've heard you say, so I did all that research and then I wanted to end it with reading the book Burn. And I've heard you say on your podcast, you've read more than a few books where the books were way too long, like they would just get to the point. That's how I felt like that Burn book was.
It's such a pet peeve of mine.
Yeah, it was like this evolutionary biology. I'm like, I just want to know, do I not lose weight after a while? Like the two chapters in the middle covered that. Great.
Yeah. We were like, that could have just been an article. Come on.
Yes. But if, and I do believe there is some validity to this constrained energy model.
Do you want to just describe what that is for people wondering?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Good point. And we live this. This isn't a shock to people when I explain it like this. If you go on a diet for an extended period of time, do you keep losing weight? The answer is no. Yeah. Eventually things slow down. And so that's if you're dieting. The other side of this is, what if you start increasing your aerobic activity and you start to lose fat initially? If you keep that aerobic activity the same level, the same duration and frequency, or let's just say the same volume for the next 6 months, are you going to keep losing body fat at the same rate? The answer is no.
Right.
That's not surprising to anybody. So I think everybody intuitively believes, yes, the body kind of works against you over time. That's essentially, to me, that's how I define the constrained energy expenditure model. And I think the popular, the mass media version of this is taken way too far, where if you do any aerobic exercise, it's worthless.
Yep.
You're going to slow down your metabolism to the point that you might as well not even do it. And that's just simply,
I've seen a more recent take on that, because that was the mainstream myth for a while. And I've seen a new one, which is, okay, fine, maybe there's not much in the way of metabolic decline or adaptation, but compensatory eating, that, like, you're just not going to be able to stop yourself from increasing your calorie intake, negating any of the caloric benefits of the exercise. That's a new one.
And because of the natural consequence of this, I dove into that literature as well. I spent a lot of time this summer on this stuff. And to that, the research has led me to think that that's not true either.
In some people, right? I mean,
highly individualized. Yeah. And I'll give you a number, like an actual number from a mathematical model where some researchers published this. I can send it to you. You may already have it. But what happens when you do anaerobic exercise? Do you eat more? The answer is yes, but it's nowhere near the increase in calories that you're eating. Does it come close to even matching the amount of calories that you expended? Two other things that I learned. The worst thing that you can do for your appetite regulation is to be sedentary. You lose your appetite regulation. So you don't know when to stop eating, even when you're full. And then you become hungry much sooner than when you should. The thing that tends to regulate your appetite the best is a moderate amount of exercise. It causes you to stop eating towards the end of a meal when you're full, and it causes you to feel fuller in between meals longer. So exercises, again, I didn't know this before. I don't spend my time on aerobic exercise focus. I'm a resistance training guy, but after going in all of these different directions, I was like, wow. Aerobic exercise isn't only a great stimulus for fat loss, it helps with not being hungry all the time. So the study that I found, and this was a recent publication, maybe within the last 2 years, they actually formulated, again, this is with mathematical modeling, based on original data, They suggested that the trade-off between the increase in appetite and the increase in food intake was about 28%. So you are going to increase your calories from aerobic exercise, but only up to 28% of the additional calories that you're expending from the exercise. So you're still in the positive about 70%. And again, if it were true that you're going to overeat from this aerobic exercise, then we wouldn't have any data that shows that you lose any fat. It wouldn't exist. Now, the counter argument to that is, I always love how you've impressed upon me. Always attack. What would the attack on me be?
I think it's the attack. It's a good exercise to.
It's an awesome exercise, and I really appreciate you for this. Yes, the studies are never 3 years long. They're not 2 years long. 20 weeks, 26 weeks, half a year, 12 weeks. So let's say this is, I'm going to take this full circle. Okay, I'll even give you that. If you did continue to exercise, maybe you get to where you're not getting a benefit. But that goes back to my 2 week study. I think there's a benefit. It helps explain, or it helps counter, this constrained energy expenditure model. If you only go into it in very short spurts, nobody makes an argument that the model exists in the first week or two of dieting. It's always after a period of time. Plus, your motivation is high. So, plus your metabolism hasn't been suppressed too much yet. So I think there's a lot of reasons to be more aggressive in short amounts of time. And that's gonna be the directive of my lab in the future.
You know, it's interesting because early on, the general approach that made the most sense to me was along these lines, not this aggressive, because I didn't want to recommend, especially think of, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago, and at least the research that I could find, I didn't feel comfortable telling people to do like what we're talking about here. But my recommendation, what made sense to me is, unless you are, again, a competitive bodybuilder, and especially a natural one who needs to spend 6 months getting, you know, striated glutes, then what makes sense for most of us is be aggressive, but don't be reckless. But let's just get it over with basically as quickly as we can. And let's use diet breaks and refeeds. Let's use little things, high protein intake. Let's limit our cardio. Let's make sure we get enough sleep. Let's do what we can to make it as, maybe enjoyable is too generous of a word, but at least as painless as possible. But let's lose that fat quickly so we can get back to building muscle, or minimally get back to maintenance, right? As opposed to, well, let's cut the rate of fat loss in half. And so let's make this thing take twice as long, this fat loss phase. And unfortunately, it's not going to make it twice as enjoyable, or it's not going to cut the pain, quote unquote, necessarily by 50%. Unfortunately, calorie restriction is funny like that, right? Where,
yeah.
Anyways, it's a neat study. I'm glad you did it. And I'm very curious to see the results in your follow-up studies. Question for you regarding the training. So, because people listening may be wondering, how were the people training generally? And you can in this study of yours, and if you want to, if there were a lot of different training programs, because people were just following their normal program, was there like an hours per week, or were they doing on average maybe 3 hours of lifting per week, 5? Was there any cardio?
Yeah. And let me also, before I forget, Alex Brooks and Jack Quint were my study coordinators for this study. So they managed all of the laboratory supervision stuff. You know, I have a very large research team, so I want to make sure I give them credit. Based on my memory, the frequency of training was 3 to 5 days per week on average.
Okay.
I think it.
So that's your normal weightlifting, you know, frequency.
Yeah. For cardio, I think it was if you were doing cardio before, you continue doing the same cardio. And obviously we didn't supervise that.
Yep.
So the only intervention that we wanted to introduce was low calorie, high protein. Everything about the other parts of their life and their world hopefully didn't change. And some of these people are already eating high protein. But they weren't eating high protein at those level, at that low of calories, obviously.
How was compliance? How did the people do on average with it? And how did they report that they felt? I'm sure some people listening are wondering, were they suffering through their final several days or their final week?
Yeah. I don't remember the exact number that dropped out. I'm looking at my spreadsheet because I made them all red who dropped out. So I think approximately 4 out of 14. So what is that? About a third of the people quit, which is, I think that's very typical. It's very typical for my research in my weight loss studies. About a third of the people. And by the way, people don't like dieting and they don't like lifting weights at the same level that they were doing before when they are dieting.
Yep.
So, plus we have early morning testing. So there's a lot of reasons for people quitting, but I would say if I were to estimate, about a third of the subjects dropped out, yep. probably just a little bit less than that.
Yep.
What was your other question?
It was,
How did they feel?
How did they feel? Yeah. How did it go for them? Like by the end
I didn't analyze this data yet. We did a hunger questionnaire and I haven't analyzed that yet.
Okay.
I went through the protocol myself, so I'll speak for myself. Yeah, now, again, sure. I'm highly motivated because this is research that I was asking other people to do. And I always try to put myself through whatever I'm going to ask subjects so I can relate. And by the way, my wife did the study as well, so I'll speak for two of us. And it wasn't as, my fear of this did not match the reality of this, which I think that's often the case with dieting. It was hard. My family has I don't want to say an addiction, but we have the habit of going out to eat on Saturday night and getting pizza after church on Sunday. So that's just what we do as a family. And of course this was COVID. So instead of going out to eat, we were bringing in food. So that weekend, that was, you know, it was like, ooh. So we had to be we had to alter what we normally do for that. I do remember that.
Which is kind of just annoying on principle. Like I have a similar, so Fridays I go and get sushi with my family and then I make pasta for us on Sunday. So I understand where it's a little bit annoying. Like I don't want to change my routine. I like my routine.
Yes. Yeah. But fortunately my wife was, she was on board too. So yeah.
So that aside.
Yeah, but me and my wife were probably the oldest people that went through this. So the younger people, maybe they just, yep, it's no big deal. But again, nearly a third of the people that quit, obviously they didn't like it or something was going on with them.
And how was it for you? How did you feel physically by the end?
I remember just getting my food. Like it was a lot of tuna. I could put a little bit of mayonnaise, a little bit of mozzarella cheese, 2 cans of tuna or 3 cans of tuna. I don't remember what it was. I remember the foods. I did a post on this where I posted everything and I didn't eat hardly any vegetables. And I probably should have during this. I just remember getting food chain. Where's your vegetables, you nutrition researcher?
Yeah, 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks.
I took a multivitamin, good enough for 2 weeks.
Not to say I shouldn't eat more vegetables, but I definitely didn't during this time. I definitely was not miserable. Now, if you take away my diet Dr. Pepper, I probably would have been miserable. Like I really rely on diet soda, diet Dr. That should be a sponsor for as much as I talk about that. that really helps my hunger for whatever reason. That curbs my hunger. So that I relied on that.
That could be an interesting follow-up podcast. Because that would be considered controversial to some people, right? Because there are a lot of people in the health space and the fitness space who they would say that because it's artificially sweetened, that diet soda is worse for you than sugar, sweetened soda. I don't agree with, but that could be an interesting discussion. Because I'm sure some people, they were like, oh, wow, like, Dr. And Campbell, a scientist, he's saying it's okay. I can drink a diet pepper when I'm cutting. Oh, wow.
Well, I wouldn't, what I would say is I do that, But,
sure. Well, then, okay, fine. Sure. I'll rephrase that. That you do that might be even just a surprise, and people are thinking now, okay, maybe that would help me too. And I understand. I don't drink soda, but I do understand. It's just the sweet, and it's just something that's nice to have when you're not eating a lot of food, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, for me, whether it's the caffeine, there's not a lot of caffeine in it, but it for whatever reason, it helps my hunger. But it is interesting. And again, I'm not an expert. I don't research this. So, I mean, someday I'd like to jump into that research. But I drink diet soda. My wife does. I don't allow my children. So not that they don't eat anything with sweeteners. I'm just saying if they're going to drink soda, and I want them to make that decision when they're 18, which, yep. I mean, back to Legion protein supplements, my children take your protein. I feel good about giving them that. Like there's no artificial sweeteners in that. And that they're like, oh, I get to be like mommy and daddy now. I get to give my protein.
Yeah, so same. My kids, that sometimes they'll want to mix a little protein powder with milk. It's cute.
Hey, protein's a lot of benefits.
Yeah, my kids, I mean, not surprising, but I'm sure yours are the same. They've been eating a high, not inappropriately high, but certainly higher than the average kid, even that. So we make sure to give them a serving of protein at lunch and dinner. And then when they want a snack, sometimes they'll grab, like we have high protein yogurt. So like Skyr yogurt, for example, the Icelandic version of the Greek yogurt craze. Mm-hmm. And so they'll grab that, or maybe they'll drink some milk. And so they get, on average, probably two or three servings that appropriate for small bodies of protein per day. And, I'm happy that is in place, because I mean, it matters. That's helping their bodies develop better, for sure.
Yes. And there's that protein leverage theory. So maybe that helps regulate their appetites better. And I have two daughters, so I'm very, again, not an expert in this area, but I'm very sensitive to potential eating disorders. Yep. So I don't like to say off limit. So again, if they want a soda when we go out to eat, nothing wrong with that.
Yep. I do. One thing I let them have a dessert every day if they want. They're just, I get them 100 calorie desserts. So maybe it's a
serving size. Yes. Exactly. That's the key. Yep. I would say by no means is my household.
No, I don't explain the calories. I don't want them to get wrapped up in that, but that's what it is. It's 100 calorie little fudge bar. They could pick that, or 100 calorie strawberry ice bar thing, or, but they're 100 calories as opposed to like 300 calorie desserts. That's not appropriate for my 4-year-old daughter. You know what I mean?
No, or just not having a bowl to put your snack in, like, eating out of the bag. Like it's, just like you, I'd love to have the time to actually speak from a place of authority, but it makes sense to me.
Totally. Totally. So anyway, coming back to this study. So let's see, those are the major questions that I had. And I guess there was one other question. And that is, what are your thoughts in terms of, let's say it's 2 weeks to 4 weeks, let's say. Let's say that people listening, the reason that they may want to go longer than 2 weeks is to get a bit more fat loss out of it. And let's say they're 2 weeks in and they're feeling pretty good. Yeah, they're a little bit hungry from time to time, but their workouts are still pretty good. And there doesn't seem to be any major issue. And they're like, all right, I'll go another week, or maybe I'll even be able to go 2 more weeks. What are your thoughts in terms of where you would implement that in the overall scheme of a fat loss phase? For example, start with it or end with it, or we already talked about this intermittent or just, now and then use of 2 to 4 weeks. And that's one way to use it. But let's say somebody has, for example, let's say somebody has a lot of fat to lose, and it wouldn't really make sense for them to be aggressive every 2 months or every 1 month. Like they really need to start with losing a lot of fat. Something that I've talked about is this person, they can get away with a larger deficit, obviously, without really any negative side effects. But I know in working with people over the years who have a lot of fat to lose, sometimes they find it motivating to start aggressively, because they see quick results and they see big results, and that just helps them get momentum and then go to something that's a bit more sustainable, because they do have, you know, maybe several months of, it doesn't have to be, of course, continuous restriction, but they have several months of dieting ahead of them, versus maybe somebody who, maybe they don't have that much fat to lose. Do you think it would ever make sense for them to maybe end their cut with a final hurrah or something else altogether?
Well, I think what I would start with, if they have the motivation at the end of their diet to do that, or if they're more inclined to do that, great. I don't think that would be the case for most people.
I don't know. You get close to the finish line on even on a work project. I've experienced that.
Well, that's true.
Right, you start motivated. And then you get into the dip, and then you're just slogging through it, and you try not to look at how much you still have in front of you, right? Maybe you try to look at how much you've already gotten done just to keep yourself in good spirits. But then as you get toward the end and you see that finish line, you know, you can get a resurgence of motivation.
Yeah, maybe that's the next study we do, a 2-week heavy or severe deficit on the first 2 weeks versus a heavy on the last 2 weeks. I assume that you're more motivated at the beginning. So I would at least.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. And then maybe taper out of it. At the end of the day, I don't think it matters if you're, whatever your caloric deficit was at the end of your period, whatever your fat loss phase was, I would say it's all the same if your caloric deficit was the same. I think it's just a matter of trying to match that caloric deficit with what you're more likely to execute on.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I don't know if it would make sense to scale up to an aggressive middle of a cut and then come down from there. I would tend to agree with you that in most people, starting aggressively, it would probably make the most sense. And then bringing it down to something again that's more sustainable for the remainder. But given the time frame that we're looking at, a lot of people, if they don't have that much fat to lose, they have maybe 8 to 10 weeks of, let's say, of cutting, and that's 8 to 10 weeks of, you know, 20-25% deficit. So they can shave some time off of that by starting aggressively, right? Like if they could get in as a good 2 to even 4 weeks of aggressive fat loss to start, that can make a big difference in terms of the total duration.
Yeah. And I think my research would give people a sense of validity to this approach, as long as protein is high and as long as you're resistance training.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for taking the time to do this. Those are all the questions I had. This was super informative. And let's wrap up with where people can find you and your work. I know you have a new ebook that just came out. And so let's definitely make sure people know about that. And then if there are any other new and exciting things that you have coming that you want to tell people about, I don't know if you're ready to announce any of them. Let's do that now too.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. So I did write a guidebook. It's called Building Your Ultimate Body. And it's basically just my philosophies on basically living a, what I call a physique lifestyle, or like a recreational bodybuilder. So we talk about fat loss phases, just like what we talked about here. There's also an entire section on resistance training. I talk about like load, effort, frequency, intensity, all of those things. And the idea is to fit your lifestyle, to fit the program to your lifestyle. So rather than give you this program, follow this program, what's your lifestyle? What can you commit to? Now, here's the best way to do this with your nutrition and with your resistance exercise. Now, there are two assumptions: that you're going to lift weights and that you're going to eat higher protein. So those are assumptions that I don't really...
Table stakes.
Yes. If you're interested, if you just go to my Instagram page, it's at Bill Campbell, PhD. Just go to the link in my bio and it takes you right to the sales page. And in terms of following my work, I'm only in one place, that's Instagram. So I try to educate people mostly on dieting, to some extent sports nutrition stuff. So at Bill Campbell, PhD is where you get what I'm working on in my lab, or just my education on this fitness lifestyle approach that I've essentially dedicated my life to, as have you.
Yeah, and great account to follow. Like, anybody still listening, you probably liked this interview. You're going to like Bill's Instagram account, just because, again, a lot of great educational information, very practical, very easy to understand. That's my kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Bill, for taking time to do this. And we should line up the next one. I know we had also on our agenda for today, there's another study that Bill did regarding flexible dieting. And I didn't know if we were going to get to it. I had a feeling that we wouldn't, that we would have a lot to talk about just on the rapid fat loss. And so let's do that in the next one, unless something even better comes along in the interim, I guess.
Yes, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to talk about that study as well.
Same. Well, I hope you liked this episode. I hope you found it helpful. And if you did, subscribe to the show, because it makes sure that you don't miss new episodes. And it also helps me because it increases the rankings of the show a little bit, which of course then makes it a little bit more easily found by other people who may like it just as much as you. And if you didn't like something about this episode or about the show in general, or if you have ideas or suggestions or just feedback to share, shoot me an email, mike@muscleforlife.com, muscleforlife.com, and let me know what I could do better, or just what your thoughts are about maybe what you'd like to see me do in the future. I read everything myself. I'm always looking for new ideas and constructive feedback. So thanks again for listening to this episode, and I hope to hear from you soon.